Okay, before continuing on with In God's Name, I just want to mention real quickly, since we're getting to the part now where there's an awful lot of names being thrown out of banks, of companies, of holding companies, of things of that nature. I think probably there's maybe one or two names of actual financial institutions that we would want you to remember by the end of the broadcast tonight. The name of the Vatican Bank, of course, and maybe the Franklin Bank, which is Franklin National, which is going to come up later in the broadcast. As for the rest of these, it's only important to remember them just so long as you're listening to the operation being explained. There's just going to be dozens and dozens of these things, and don't feel bad if you cannot remember back to Mabusi Bitalaigung and Privat Credit Bank and things like, because a lot of these just show up a couple of times. They're used briefly by Sindona or Calvi or Marcinkus or whoever, and then they're sort of pushed aside again. So don't feel that you have to follow all of these names, except just to get the understanding in each particular case of what exactly, more or less, is being done. Anyway, continuing on with Yalop's book. Sindona and his close friend since 1968, Roberto Calvi of Banco Ambrosiano, openly boasted that they controlled the Milan Stock Exchange at this time. It was a control they criminally exploited again and again. Shares went up and down like yo-yos. Games were played with companies for the amusement and financial benefit of Sindona and his associates. The manipulation of a company called Pacchetti gives an example of the everyday activities of these men. Pacchetti began life as a small, insignificant leather tanning company. Sindona acquired it in 1969 and decided to transform it into a conglomerate. He took as his model Gulf and Western, whose widespread interests ranged from Paramount Studios through publishing to airlines, and whose chairman, Charles Bludhorn, served on the board of Immobiliare. Sindona's acquisitions for Pacchetti were more modest. In fact, it became a commercial garbage can containing interest in unprofitable steelworks and commercially unsuccessful household cleaners. There was, however, one jewel in it. He had acquired from Bishop Marcinkus an option to purchase Banca Cattolica del Veneto. Doubtless, the fact that the president of Pacchetti, Massimo Spada, was also the managing director of the Vatican Bank, helped Marcinkus forget the prior claims of the Veneto clergy and Patriarch Luciani. Okay, let me again make this clear. Now, in most of these cities, there are these private banks or these banks that are heavily affiliated with the Catholic Church. Again, Italy is a country where, since 1929, the Roman Catholicism has been not only the unofficial state religion, but in fact, since the Lateran Treaty, the official state religion. In many of these cities, the banks are sometimes affiliated directly with the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. In Venice, Patriarch Albino Luciani, we mentioned him before, he's going to wind up being John Paul I for a very short period of time. Luciani and his loyalists in Venice were, again, as usual, using the bank for the business of the Catholic Church in that area. And as we're going to see later in the broadcast, this was one of the things that led Albino Luciani to find out firsthand exactly what kind of manipulation Sindona and Calvi and Marcinkus were up to.
It's a good point. The name here, the Banca Cattolica del Veneto, is a very important element in this tangle that we're going to be hopefully unraveling for you. So remember that, because it's very, very important with regard to Albino Luciani and his interests in this in Vatican, what Yalop refers to as Vatican Incorporated. And by the way, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills.
That's right, because as mentioned before, Luciani and his people, because of the fact that they are the Catholic hierarchy of the local Catholic hierarchy of Venice, are, you know, banking, and the church is banking. The representatives of the Venice branch, I guess you could say, of the Catholic Church are banking through this Banca Cattolica del Veneto. But as we're going to see later on, all of a sudden, Luciani, the home team, gets bumped out by the visitors, who are spearheaded by Michele Sindona and Archbishop Marcinkus of the Vatican Bank. Roberto Calvi, who was a party to the Veneto negotiations, agreed to buy on a specified date a Sindona company called Zitropo. The way was now paved for yet another illegal manipulation of the Milan Stock Exchange. The book value of the Pacchetti shares was about 250 lira per share. Sindona instructed the Stock Exchange Department of the Banca Unione to purchase Pacchetti shares. By using nominees, the shares were then illegally parked in Sindona-owned companies. The price of the shares began to surge dramatically, eventually reaching 1,600 lira on the exchange. In March 1972, the day for Calvi's purchase of Zitropo duly arrived. Simultaneously, all the Sindona companies dumped their Pacchetti shares into Zitropo. The effect was to inflate artificially the value of Zitropo. Calvi paid an astronomically higher price than the company was worth. Sindona, having funded the entire operation with fictitious guarantees, made a huge illegal profit. An indication of just how much profit he made on this one operation emerges from the fact that in 1978, a government-appointed liquidator, Giorgio Ambrosoli, discovered powerful evidence that Sindona had paid a kickback to Calvi of $6.5 million, which Calvi shared 50-50 with Bishop Paul Marcinkus. Now, this is important for a variety of reasons. First of all, as we will find out later in the broadcast, the government-appointed liquidator, Giorgio Ambrosoli, was liquidated by a Sindona-appointed liquidator himself, partially because of this particular deal, but also because of some other deals. But it is interesting to notice that one of the things he was involved in was uncovering the fact that Sindona paid a kickback to Calvi that Calvi split with Bishop Paul Marcinkus. Going along, why would Calvi pay so much over the market value for Zitropo? There are three reasons. First, he used money belonging to others to effect the purchase. Second, there was a $3.25 million profit for him. That's, again, his half of the kickback. Third, at the conclusion of the Pacchetti-Zitropo deal, he acquired an option to buy Banca Cattolica del Veneto, the option that Sindona had earlier acquired from Marcinkus. The fact that no one had consulted Albino Luciani, remember the future John Paul I, the Patriarch of Venice, or the members of his diocese who had lodged their shares with the Vatican Bank, was considered irrelevant by Bishop Marcinkus. Sindona and Calvi became very adept at this form of robbery. Never in the history of banking has so much been paid for so little. In 1972, Calvi pocketed a further $5 million from Sindona when Bastoghi shares changed hands, and an additional 540 million Swiss francs, about $140 million, when Sindona sold him 7,200 shares in Fina Bank. Each time, Sindona paid the kickbacks to Calvi through his MANI account in Fina Bank. These huge amounts were paid into Calvi's secret Swiss accounts, which he held jointly with his wife. At the Union de Banque Suisse and Credit Bank of Zurich, the Calvis held four secret accounts. And then he gives the account numbers, which we don't really need. The very minimum that Sindona himself would have made on each deal was equivalent to the amount he was kicking back to Calvi. Roberto Calvi developed an insatiable appetite for this particular game, and on occasion played it as a solo performer. Hence, he obliged one of his own banks, Centrale, to buy a large block of Toro Assicurazioni shares in 1976 for 25 billion lira, close to $30 million, more than they were worth. The 25 billion ended up in one of the Swiss accounts previously noted. So did a further 20 billion lira after Calvi played the game again with over 1 million shares in Centrale. These huge sums were not just items on a balance sheet. The money physically moved from a variety of shareholders' pockets directly into the pockets of the Calvis in Sindona. The shares in the Banca Cattolica were also subjected to this treatment. Sindona was aware that Calvi was negotiating with Marcinkus to acquire control of the bank, hence the share push. At the end of that exercise, everyone except the Veneto diocese was immeasurably richer. Calvi had been introduced to Marcinkus by Sindona in 1971. Thus, Bishop Marcinkus, the man who on his own admission, quote, knew nothing about banking, unquote, had two excellent tutors. Meanwhile, Marcinkus had been promoted by Pope Paul and was now president of the Vatican Bank. The various Vatican departments continued to unload a wide variety of companies on Sindona and then on Calvi. In 1970, for example, they finally sold Sereno, a pharmaceutical company that featured among its more successful lines an oral contraceptive pill. An additional source of profit for the Sindona-Vatican-owned Fina Bank was another part of the cause of Italy's faltering economy, double invoicing. As Bordoni observed, it was less succulent than the kickbacks earned through the illegal exportation of black money, but it still reached a high figure. Exports would be invoiced at costs that were much lower than the real ones. Thus, the doctored invoice would be officially paid via the Bank of Italy, which, of course, would pass the information on to the taxation department. The exporter would be taxed on this low figure. The balance was paid by the receiver of the goods abroad direct to Finabank. In many instances, Italian exporters actually showed a loss, which was converted into tax credits by the government. The large number of Sindona-owned exporting companies showed such losses. Sindona would bribe various politicians to allow the situation to continue. He would also argue that by doing so, the government was helping to keep down unemployment. A similar crime was worked on imports. Then the invoice would be for a much higher figure than the actual cost of the goods. When the goods passed through customs, payment of the artificially high figure would be made by the company to the foreign supplier. The foreign supplier, in turn, would assign the balance to a numbered account at Finabank, or occasionally one of the other Swiss banks. Pope Paul's poor church for the poor grew instead immeasurably richer. The Vatican divestment of Italian wealth had resulted in men such as Sindona and Calvi robbing the world to pay St. Peter and an apparently oblivious Pope Paul. So again, looking back, key things to realize, the kind of manipulations, again, all the names are not so important, but we see a series of very similar kinds of manipulations, one in which the value of a company is grotesquely maneuvered upward far above its actual value. Then Sindona or Calvi, depending, would force the bank that they were in charge of to take the shareholders' money and buy this inflated company. Then, of course, since they were already part owners of these companies, they would then pocket the additional profits far above what the company was actually worth. And, of course, as usual, the people picking up the tab were the shareholders of the banks. As mentioned also, they mentioned double invoicing on exporting and on importing. And again, the key thing to note, is not only the involvement of Calvi and Sindona, which of course at this point is not much of a surprise, but the involvement of the Vatican Bank and the Vatican Bank's involvement in many cases in direct flouting of the authority of the local Catholic hierarchy, and specifically in the case of Venice, the flouting of Patriarch Albino Luciani in his Venetian diocese.
It's worth noting that Archbishop Marcinkus himself, in addition to his poor stewardship, actually illegal stewardship of the Vatican Bank here, also pocketed a lot of the money that was gleaned from the scams of Calvi, Sindona, and company. Again, the government of Italy had eliminated the tax-exempt status of Italian investments in Italy precisely because of the fact that had grown to be a huge strain on the Italian economy and a drain on the Italian people. The resulting machinations stemming from Michele Sindona's hiring as Vatican financial advisor and, in turn, the drain of assets out of Italy worsened the situation. It's worth noting that the direct conflict here between the interests of the church and its wealth and that of the state of Italy itself.
Okay, we're going to take a break for a few minutes and let some of these bank names bubble around in your heads and bubble around in ours. And then we will be back to continue along the paper trail and with Dave Emery. And we are continuing with part two of the Mediterranean Merry-Go-Round, our special Month of Mayhem extravaganza. Folks, and believe me, this is an extravaganza with tentacles reaching out to all sections of the world. And tonight we're talking mainly about the financial aspects, and we're examining portions of the careers of such Catholic church luminaries, and Vatican luminaries, as Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the American-born director of the Vatican Bank, Michele Sindona, once known as God's banker, Roberto Calvi, once known as St. Peter's banker, Licio Gelli.
Other way around with the two. That makes a whole lot of difference. Michele is St. Peter's and Calvi was God's.
You're absolutely right.
So you pays your money and you takes your church, I guess, huh?
Something like that. And Licio Gelli, who I don't know who you, I guess he might be Otto Scorzini's banker or something, I'm not quite sure, and a variety of other folks. And, of course, we're beginning now to hear the name of Albino Luciani, who started out in our series tonight as Patriarch of Venice and will go on to become Pope John Paul I, and shortly after that, immediately before initiating a sweeping investigation into Vatican finances and Vatican connections to the Mafia and the P2 and fascist front organizations, he will become the late John Paul I. We have just finished hearing a long section detailing some of the particular scams that Sindona and Calvi were running on behalf of, among other things, on behalf of the Vatican Church. Of course, Sindona especially had clients as diverse besides the Vatican as, well, maybe not diverse, but clients as distinct. Well, maybe not even distinct, but he had clients like the Mafia and the CIA. I just realized I'd have to back and fill on that, you know, from we've got longtime listeners who know better. And we detailed some of the scams, the double invoicing scams, the false inflation of the value of companies that were actually owned by the same people who were buying them, so that the only people who lost money were the shareholders, et cetera, et cetera.
And again, remember that how this grows out of our previous program. Alessio Gelli, Oberleutnant in the SS, works on the Ratline with Cardinal Montini. Later, Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge, a Shea crypto-fascist government operating primarily in Italy but all over the world, then is instrumental in the person of Umberto Ortolani in getting Cardinal Montini to become Pope Paul VI. That Pope then brings in P2 member Michele Sindona as the Vatican financial advisor, and we're basically off to the races. But keeping in mind the association of Gelli and then Cardinal Montini on the Rat Line, and how later Gelli's P2 Lodge came to bring Montini to the papacy, and Montini, Paul VI, brings Michele Sindona of P2 right into the very heart of Vatican financing. Continuing now with the account, basically, of Michele Sindona, Licio Gelli, and some of the interesting things that they were involved in here. Again, reading from In God's Name by David Yalop. By the late 1960s, Michele Sindona was a member of P2 and also a close friend of Licio Gelli. Sindona had much in common with Gelli, not least the close attention they were both paid by the CIA and Interpol. The functions of these two organizations do not always run in tandem. Interpol's investigation of Sindona is a powerful illustration of this. In November of 1967, Interpol Washington telexed the following message to the Rome police headquarters, quote, "Recently, we have received unverified information that the following individuals are involved in the illicit movement of depressant, stimulant, and hallucinogenic drugs between Italy, the United States, and possibly other European countries. Leading off a list of four names was Michele Sindona." The Italian police replied that they had no evidence to link Sindona with the drug trade. A copy of the Interpol request and the response were in Sindona's hands the same week. A similar request by Interpol Washington to the CIA, operating out of the embassy in Rome and the legation in Milan, if answered honestly, would have produced confirmation that the information Interpol had was entirely correct. The CIA file on Sindona was by this time extensive. I would add that next week we're going to look into how the CIA used Sindona. That's going to be somewhat in the background of this broadcast, but continuing. The CIA file on Sindona was by this time extensive. It details Sindona's links with the New York Gambino Mafia family, with its 253 members and its 1,147 associates, unquote. It tells how the five New York Mafia families, Colombo, Bonanno, Gambino, Lucchese, and Genovese, were interlocked in a range of crimes that included drug refining, smuggling, and dealing, the drugs in question being heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. Further criminal activities of these mafia families that are annotated in the CIA files include prostitution, gambling, pornography, usury, protection racketeering, fraud, and large-scale thefts from banks and pension funds. The files are full of details of how the Sicilian mafia families in Zerillo and Spatola moved the refined heroin from Sicily to their colleagues in New York, of their infiltration of the Italian airline Alitalia, and of how $50,000 contracts were awarded by the New York families to associates to collect unaccompanied baggage from Palermo, baggage containing heroin that had been refined at one of the five Inzerillo narcotics laboratories in Sicily. By the late 1960s, the profits from heroin sales to these two Sicilian families were over $500 million per year. The files detail the journeys of the nearly 30 ships per year that until very recently left Lebanese ports with cargoes of both unrefined and refined heroin destined for a variety of ports in southern Italy. The most serious question this information raises is, why did such incriminating evidence lie dormant and unused throughout the 1960s and 70s? The CIA never initiates policy. I would say that that should be regarded as Yalop's opinion. We've looked at in the Guns of November a few instances of them doing just that, not to mention Turple and Wilson and some others. But continuing here, the CIA never initiates policy. It merely implements or attempts to implement presidential instructions. Did a succession of presidents take the view that the Mafia's activities were to be tolerated if they helped to ensure that NATO member Italy did not fall to the communists through the polling booths? The Mafia families themselves desperately needed men like Michele Sindona. The extraordinary growth of bank deposits and the array of new banks and branches in Sicily, one of the poorest regions in the country, is mute testimony to the size of the Mafia's problem. Enter Michele Sindona. On one occasion, Sindona was asked where he obtained the money for his grandiose schemes. He replied, quote, 95% of it is other people's money, unquote. It was a response that was 95% true. The most important aspect of this passage being that Michele Sindona was a key mafioso, a very important man with regard to a number of different mafia scams, and was basically a mafia banker in Italy, the key mafia banker. And remember now that this man is not only a member of the P2 Lodge, but is the Vatican financial advisor at the same time as he's a key mafia banker. So basically we have the mafia ushered right into the innermost sancta of the Vatican here.
Now, they mentioned there in the article that by his own admission that Sindona was largely using other people's money. Sindona was also stealing other people's money and trampling on the financial rights of others. And among the people whose financial rights were trampled on were those of the diocese, the Catholic diocese of Venice. And as we mentioned before, the Patriarch of Venice at this time in the early 1970s was Albino Luciani.
Also, now, not only, we're going to be coming back to the Banca Cattolica or Cattolica di Veneto, when the scam involved in that, it's going to be touched on again here very briefly. But remember the Mafia Association, because and in turn, the association between Sindona and the Vatican, because we're going to begin looking at a tightening of those particular connections right here, namely the Vatican and the Mafia.
That's right, and we're also going to see the lines laid for a future confrontation that was narrowly avoided by the death of John Paul I, a very convenient death. 2 months later, in May, Luciani, again, that's Albino Luciani, Patriarch of Venice, Luciani found himself playing host yet again to a visitor from Rome, Giovanni Benelli, B-E-N-E-L-L-I. In general, Benelli had come to assure him that the problems they had discussed the previous year had not been forgotten. And we talked about some of those problems. They had to do, again, with the Vatican Bank and Sindona's manipulation of the Banca Cattolica di Veneto. In general, Benelli had come to assure him that the problems they had discussed the previous year had not been forgotten. In particular, he had an extraordinary story to tell. It concerned the American Mafia, nearly $1 billion worth of counterfeit securities, and Bishop Paul Marcinkus. On April 25, 1973, Benelli had received some very unusual guests in his office at the Secretariat of State in Vatican City. William Lynch, chief of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section of the U.S. Department of Justice, and William Ehrenwald, assistant chief of the strike force in the Southern District of New York. Two members of the FBI had accompanied them. Quote, having met these gentlemen from the United States, Benelli later told me in an interview, meaning told Yollop, I made my apologies and left them in the capable hands of three of my staff. They, of course, subsequently reported to me exactly what had taken place. The secret FBI report that I, the author, acquired many months after my conversation with Cardinal Benelli confirmed that his account was very accurate. It also told a story that reads like an outline for a Hollywood movie. Monsignors Edward Martinez, Carl Rauber, and Justin Regali listened while William Lynch told of a police investigation that had begun in the world of the New York Mafia and had led inexorably to the Vatican. And by the way, we should mention that this particular operation is detailed from the point of view of one of the unwitting participants in a book called The Vatican Connection.
By Richard Hammer, and it's worth noting, in fact, we'll interrupt at this point perhaps, to note that a lot of the books that we're using are not only all the books either recently out of publication and therefore probably still available, or they're in publication in the case of The Vatican Connection by Richard Hammer, and In God's Name, the book which we're relying primarily upon this evening. Both of those books are out in paperback at this time, so if people would like to pursue this at greater length, never been a better time or an easier way to do it than these paperbacks. But again, Richard Hammer's The Vatican Connection, out in soft cover, and that sums up and details the scam that Nip is reading you right now from Yollop's account.
Okay. Told of a police investigation that had begun in the world of the New York Mafia and had led inexorably to the Vatican. He told the priest that a package of $14.5 million of American counterfeit bonds had been carefully and painstakingly created by a network of members of the Mafia in the United States. A package had been delivered to Rome in July 1971, and there was substantial evidence to establish that the ultimate destination of those bonds was the Vatican Bank. Lynch advised them that much of the evidence from separate sources also indicated that someone with financial authority within the Vatican had ordered the fake bonds. He pointed out that other evidence strongly indicated the $14.5 million was merely a down payment, and that the counterfeit bonds ordered were in fact worth a total of $950 million. That's nearly a billion, folks, for those of you out there who are not too hip with numbers. The attorney then revealed the name of the, quote, someone with financial authority, unquote, who had masterminded the illegal transaction. On the basis of the evidence in Lynch's hands, now bear in mind that Lynch is the chief of the organized crime and racketeering section of the U.S. Department of Justice, not somebody to lightly cast around accusations. On the basis of the evidence in Lynch's hands, it was Bishop Paul Marcinkus. Displaying remarkable self-control, the three priests listened as the two U.S. attorneys outlined their evidence. At this stage of the investigation, a number of the conspirators had already been arrested. One of them, who had felt the desire to unburden himself, was Mario Foligni, self-styled, quote, Count of San Francisco, with an honorary doctorate in theology. A first-class con man, Foligni had on more than one occasion narrowly avoided prison. When he was suspected of having manipulated the fraudulent bankruptcy of a company he controlled, a magistrate in Rome had issued a search warrant to the finance police. Opening Foligni's safe, the police had discovered a signed blessing from Pope Paul VI. They had apologized for the intrusion and departed. Subsequently, others had been equally impressed with Foligni's Vatican connections. He had opened the Vatican doors to an Austrian named Leopold Ledl, L-E-D-L. It was Ledl who had put the Vatican deal together, the purchase of $950 million of counterfeit bonds with a purchase price of $635 million. A, quote, commission of $150 million would be paid back by the gang to the Vatican, leaving the Mafia with $485 million and the Vatican with bonds that had a face value of nearly $1 billion. Okay, so just to make that clear real quickly what's going on, the Mafia folks who got these bonds together, they were $950 million worth of bonds, but they are fake bonds. In the real world, they are actually worth nothing as far as any legal value. They were going to be sold to the Vatican, apparently, for $635 million, which then would, a kickback would go to the Vatican of $150 million. So the Mafia would get a $485 million free and clear, and the Vatican would get fake bonds with a value of almost $1 billion.
Remember, as you hear Marcinkus going through this, that he was born and grew up in Cicero, Illinois, which was the stomping grounds of Al Capone. That'll be touched on later in the broadcast.
The American Mafia had been skeptical about the deal until Ledl had produced a letter from the Vatican, written under the letterhead of the Sacra Congregazione dei Religiosi. It was confirmation that the Vatican wished to, quote, buy the complete stock of the merchandise up to the sum of $950 million, unquote. Foligni had told the American investigators that Marcinkus, ever prudent, had requested that a trial deposit of $1.5 million of the bonds be made at Handelsbank in Zurich. According to Foligni, Marcinkus had wanted to satisfy himself that the bonds would pass as genuine. Late in July 1971, the trial deposit was duly made by Foligni. He nominated Vatican cleric Monsignor Mario Fornasari as the beneficiary of the account he opened. A second trial deposit of $2.5 million of the bonds had been made at the Banco di Roma in September 1971. On both occasions, the bonds had passed bank scrutiny, a tribute to Mafia skill. Regrettably for the conspirators, however, both banks had sent samples to New York for physical examination. The Bankers Association in New York ascertained that the bonds were false, hence the unusual presence of American attorneys and men from the FBI within the Vatican walls. Apart from a desire to recover the balance of $10 million of the initial delivery, Lynch and his colleagues were anxious to bring all the participants in the crime to justice. Foligni had told the investigators that the reason that the Vatican required the fake bonds was to enable Marcinkus and Italian banker and businessman Michele Sindona to buy Bastoghi, a giant Italian company with wide interests including property, mining, and chemicals. Bastoghi's headquarters were in Milan, so were Sindona's. It was in this city that the then Archbishop Montini, later Pope Paul VI, had met Sindona. When Montini had become pope, the Vatican gained a new heir to Peter, and the Vatican Bank gained a new lay financial advisor, Michele Sindona. William Lynch, himself a devout Catholic, continued his story. Mario Foligni, it transpired, had fired a series of accusations at Bishop Marcinkus during the U.S. Department of Justice interrogations. Apart from the allegation that Sindona and Marcinkus had planned to buy Bastogi with fake bonds, Foligni had also asserted that with Sindona's assistance, the bishop had established several secret numbered bank accounts in the Bahamas for his personal use. Under interrogation, Mario Foligni had claimed that he had been working personally with Benelli's office, the Secretariat of State, and that as a direct result of his cooperation, quote, the Secretary of State had caused stringent administrative action to be taken against Bishop Marcinkus, which severely restricted the bishop's enormous financial power within the Vatican, end quote. Foligni had insisted that he had told the Secretariat of State of the trial deposits he had made in Switzerland and Rome, and that this information was used by Benelli's office against Marcinkus. Foligni had also advised the Justice Department that he was under orders from the Secretary of State's office, again, that's the Secretary of State of the Vatican, not to give the investigators any further details concerning the swindle. Having put this evidence forward, the Americans sat back and waited for a response. As William Lynch and William Ehrenwald made clear when I interviewed them, this first meeting at the Vatican was not seen by either side as an interrogation. It was informal, an opportunity to lay before members of the Vatican's Secretariat of State some very serious allegations. The Justice Department was aware that the central thrust of the allegations stemmed from two expert con men, but there was also powerful internal evidence to support the validity of the statements of Foligni and Ladle. It was because of that evidence that William Ehrenwald had contacted Cardinal Cook of New York via the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. The Cardinal had been most cooperative, and through the papal delegation in Washington, this extraordinary meeting had been arranged. Its real object was not merely to lay down the information, but ultimately to confront Marcinkus. While more coffee was served, the three Monsignors remained silent but thoughtful. Eventually, Monsignor Martinez, assessor of the Cardinal Secretary of State's office, responded. He assured the Americans that he and Monsignor Rauber had complete knowledge of all the affairs of Archbishop Benelli, and categorically denied that Foligni had turned over any evidence to Benelli's office. As for the counterfeit bonds and the trial deposits, this was the first time that anyone in the Secretariat of State had heard about the affair. Taking a classic curial position, he remarked, quote, it is not the intention of the Vatican to collaborate with the United States officials in their investigation at this point, since this is considered to be an informal meeting, and our purpose at the present time is only to listen, unquote. What Lynch and his colleagues were confronted with was a mentality that had defeated many minds better than theirs, that of the Curia, a body of men that gives absolutely nothing away, a government machine that holds the Roman Catholic Church in a vice-like grip. Lynch reminded the Monsignors that to date only $4 million of the fake bonds, remember that's out of an original $950 million, $4 million of the fake bonds had been recovered, and continued, quote, since all evidence strongly indicates that the eventual destination for all of the bonds was the Vatican Bank, and in view of the fact that the total amount ordered is worth $950 million, perhaps I can give you a list of the types of bonds, unquote. Martinez merely swayed out of the path of that punch. Lynch persisted. That way, the records of the Instituto per le Opere de Religione, which is the IOR, the Vatican Bank, can be checked to determine if any of the counterfeit stocks have been inadvertently received on deposit at that bank. The style of Martinez in the ring, Yallop writes, was really most impressive. Quote, I, of course, have no idea if any of these American counterfeit bonds have been received by our bank. I cannot, however, take a list from you to check. That would be the function of Bishop Marcinkus. He handles such matters. Perhaps if you have difficulty in contacting the bishop, you might send a list with a formal letter to the papal nuncio in Washington. Unquote. It was obviously time for a change of tactics.
Continuing, the U.S. attorneys produced a document they had taken from Leopold Ladle after his arrest. The Vatican seal was on the letterhead, below which was printed Sacra Congregazione dei Religiosi. It was the Vatican order for nearly $1 billion worth of counterfeit securities. It had convinced the mafia. The Monsignors examined it carefully. There was much staring and holding up to the light. Martinez rubbed his chin thoughtfully. The Americans leaned forward eagerly. Perhaps they had finally gotten one past the redoubtable Martinez. Quote, The letterhead appears to be identical to the letterhead of one of our sacred congregations that is located here in the Vatican, unquote. There was pause. Just time for the Americans to savor the moment, then Martinez continued. However, I would note that while the letterhead appears to be legitimate, that particular congregation changed its name in 1968, and that as of the date of this letter, June 29, 1971, the name shown on the letterhead would be incorrect. The new name is Sacra Congregazione per I Religiosi e gli Istituti Secolari. Please forgive my Italian here. The American investigators had, however, succeeded in their main objective. It was agreed that they could see Bishop Paul Marchinkus face to face the following day. This in itself was an extraordinary achievement, for Vatican City fiercely guards its independent statehood. During my interview with Cardinal Benelli, he confirmed that he had indeed received information about the whole affair from Mario Foligni before the Vatican visit of the American investigators. It had seemed to the Cardinal to be a self-serving effort by Foligni, who by that time knew the game was up. As to the validity of the information, Benelli confined himself to the observation that he found the information very interesting and useful. On the morning of April 26, 1973, the two American attorneys and the two FBI men were shown into the private office of Bishop Paul Marchinkus. Lynch and Aronwald repeated the story they had told the previous day, while Marchinkus puffed on a large cigar. In the light of some of his subsequent evasions, his initial remark is of particular interest. Quote, I am very disturbed by the seriousness of the allegations. In view of them, I'll answer each and every question to the best of my ability. He began with Michele Sindona. Michele and I are very good friends. We've known each other for several years. My financial dealings with him, however, have only been very limited. Interrupting, evaluate the correctness of that statement with the information we've just presented.
And also, just because we're going to come back to that particular statement later in the broadcast, remember that at this initial meeting that he told the American investigators that Michele Sindona was a good friend of his.
And also that his financial dealings with him, however, have been only very limited. He is, you know, one of the wealthiest industrialists in Italy. He is well ahead of his time as far as financial matters are concerned, unquote. He extolled the virtues and talents of Michele Sindona at some considerable length. Then, placing the Vatican Bank on a par with the confessional, Marchinkus remarked, quote, I would prefer to withhold names in many of the instances I intend to give, because although the charges that Foligni makes against me are extremely serious, they are so wild that I do not believe it necessary to break banking secrecy laws in order to defend myself, unquote. While the previous day's meeting had been largely of an informal nature, this confrontation with Marchinkus was an interrogation. On the evidence that the U.S. Department of Justice had carefully and painstakingly acquired over more than 2 years, Lynch and Aronwald and FBI agents Biamonti and Tamaro had before them the man who had masterminded one of the world's greatest swindles. If the evidence was correct, then the claim for world notoriety of the Chicago suburb of Cicero would be in the future shared by Al Capone and Paul Marchinkus. William Lynch raised the temperature a little. If it becomes necessary at some future date, you will make yourself available for a face-to-face confrontation with Mario Foligni. Yes, I will. If it becomes necessary, this, by the way, is Lynch interrogating, if it becomes necessary, are you also prepared to testify in a United States court? Well, yes, if it's absolutely necessary. I hope it won't be, though. Why? Well, the only people who would gain anything if I appeared in court would be the Italian press. How's that? They frequently relish the opportunity to write inflammatory material concerning the Vatican, whether it's true or not. Lynch and Aronwald showed a total lack of concern for the Vatican's sensitivity toward the Italian press. Do you have a private numbered account in the Bahamas? No. Do you have an ordinary account in the Bahamas? No, I don't. Are you quite certain, Bishop? The Vatican does have a financial interest in the Bahamas, but it's strictly a business transaction, similar to many controlled by the Vatican. It's not for any one person's private financial gain. No, we are interested in personal accounts that you have. I don't have any private or public accounts in the Bahamas or anywhere else, unquote. How Marchinkus constantly carried his salary and expenses around in cash was not explored. It would have made him the first president of a bank in the world's history without a personal bank account. Neither did Marchinkus reveal that he was, in fact, on the board of directors of Banco Ambrosiano overseas in Nassau, and had been since 1971. By the way, that's Roberto Calvi's bank, also intimately involved with Vatican machinations, and we're going to talk about that later. He had been invited onto the board by the two men who had set up this Bahamas operation, Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi. Both men used the bishop's name frequently in their business deals. Sindona put it bluntly to Marchinkus on one occasion. I put you on the board because your name helps me to raise money. Sindona and Calvi showed their gratitude by giving Marcinkus and the Vatican Bank 2.5% of the Nassau Bank stock. This figure eventually rose to 8%. Marcinkus frequently attended board meetings and took holidays in the Bahamas. At this point in the interrogation, Bishop Marcinkus observed, "You know, my position within the Vatican is unique." One of the world's great understatements was followed by, "I'm in charge of what many people commonly refer to as the Vatican Bank. As such, I have complete control of Vatican financial affairs. One of the things that makes my position completely unique is that I am answerable only to the Pope as to how I handle those financial affairs. In theory, my operations are directed by a group of cardinals who meet from time to time and generally act as overseers to the bank. In reality, however, I virtually have a sole hand in directing the financial affairs of the Vatican," unquote. The personal testimony did not impress the bishop's listeners. "What's the point you're trying to make?" "Well, this position that I hold has led to, shall we say, certain hard feelings by other men in responsible positions within the Vatican." "Really?" "Oh, yes, it's just part of the job, I'm afraid. I am the first American ever to have risen to such a position of power within the Vatican, and I'm sure that this has also caused a certain amount of hard feelings," unquote. Whether or not he was guilty of being the mastermind behind this enormous swindle, Paul Marcinkus undoubtedly spoke the truth when he talked about certain hard feelings, unquote, held by other senior men within the Vatican, and not only there. In Venice, Cardinal Albino Luciani's feelings towards Marcinkus grew somewhat more than hard as Benelli told him of this latest episode in the Marcinkus saga. Ironically, what Benelli did not know was that during that private interview with the American investigators, Paul Marcinkus had attempted to entangle him in the swindle. To read the statement Marcinkus made, it is clear that in his eyes, everyone but himself merited investigation. Of Father Mario Fornasari, who was allegedly deeply involved in the affair, Marcinkus noted, "Some of the people who work for me at the bank have pointed Fornasari out to me as an individual to avoid. I'm sure you know that Fornasari was denounced some time ago for writing libelous letters." "Really? What happened?" "I believe the charges were dropped," unquote. Marcinkus conceded that he had been involved with Mario Follini, without doubt one of the principal figures in the billion-dollar swindle, on at least two business ventures. The first concerned a $100 million investment scheme that did not come to fruition. The second was a $300 million deal involving Follini and Italian industrialist Carlo Pacenti. That, too, had aborted, but as Marcinkus told his convoluted tale, he was at pains to drag in Benelli's name. Apart from inadvertently demonstrating that his ego had been bruised because Benelli had asked Pope Paul to consider the $300 million deal, and Marcinkus clearly believed that no one but he should talk to the Pope about money, Marcinkus attempted to link Benelli and Follini, presumably working on the law of guilt by association. In view of the subsequent activities of Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi, both close friends of Marcinkus, it would be interesting to know if Marcinkus still holds to this dubious tenet. What Marcinkus neglected to explain, perhaps because he was not asked to, was why he was even prepared to consider the $300 million deal involving Follini some 8 months after Follini had unloaded $1.5 million of fake securities in a Swiss bank, and some 6 months after he had unloaded $2.5 million of phony bonds in the Banco di Roma. It is inconceivable that Marcinkus did not know of these criminal activities. All banks were alerted. At the end of a long interrogation, Marcinkus maintained total innocence and disclaimed all knowledge. He happily accepted a list of the counterfeit bonds and said he would keep his eyes open for them. A variety of people were eventually found guilty of involvement in the billion-dollar swindle. With regard to the allegations that Bishop Paul Marcinkus was involved, attorney William Aronwald told me, quote, "The most that could be said is that we were satisfied that the investigation had not disclosed sufficiently credible evidence to prove or disprove the allegation. Consequently, since we were not morally satisfied ourselves that there was anything wrong or that Marcinkus or anyone else in the Vatican had done anything wrong, it would have been improper of us to try to grab some headlines."